This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Fender Bender on Joy 94.9, revving up the weekends with news and views on all things motoring.
Yes, hello once again and welcome to another edition of Fender Bender. My name is Tim Nicholson. I am super jazzed to have your company today. If you are into motoring, anything automotive, you are in the right place. This is Joy's very own motoring program, so stick with us for the next hour and we're going to be going through all of the fun things that have been happening in the automotive world this week. Big thanks, of course, to Luke and the gang for Critical Hit. They will be back next week, so you should listen in. I'm joined by some lovely men who I'll introduce shortly. We are quite obviously going to be talking a lot about the Volkswagen saga today. So if you want to know what the hell is happening, probably best go to another station because they'll know more. No, I'm kidding. We'll know all about it. We're going to tell you all about it and hopefully alleviate some fears as well that I should probably introduce. Hi, guys. We have the lovely Mike Costello returning from an overseas jaunt. Not a joint. Well.
What?
An overseas jaunt. Mm-hmm. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. No joints? No.
I'm good. No. I'm a little bit... I don't really know what time it is.
Yeah, when did you get back?
Late last night from London. And I think it's always the second day when the jet lag gets me. So today is fine, but it's like the precipice is approaching.
It's going to hit. Yeah. And you know what you should probably do? Just go out and turtle yourself tonight because it's...
Maybe. Yeah.
Probably
it the tends to be the strategy. And I've been trying to, you know, keep... pretty much away from the world of motoring and cars, and yet the biggest automotive news story in ages, if not ever, brakes.
I know, right?
Timing.
It's probably...
So you can't really escape it. It's kind of inevitable. Yeah. This thing is enormous, the Volkswagen thing. So,
especially if you were in Europe.
Yes.
But yeah, so
that's the epicenter of the whole drama.
Exactly.
So we're going to really delve deep into that today. Should
we
be good.
We like to delve deep. Speaking of delving deep, Kez Casey is here as well. Hi, Kez.
Hi, Tim.
Did you like that introduction?
There's been two excellent euphemisms thrown out, and we've been on air for 7 minutes and 12 seconds. So this is excellent.
It's probably not going to be the last. Kez, how have you been this week?
I have been busy.
Yeah.
As you know, it's been an enormous week. Mm. But other than that, pretty damn good.
Just hanging out. Hanging out for more VW goss.
Absolutely.
That's true. Well, look, we're going to go into detail about that very shortly. It is the biggest news item of our lives. Let's be honest, guys. It's pretty massive. So there's a lot to kind of wrap our heads around, and you guys probably know quite a bit about it. If you've got any questions as well, we'd love to hear from you. If you're concerned, if you're a VW owner, text in 0427JOY949 or email onair@joy.org.au. We can hopefully help you out or point you in the right direction or, I don't know, just have a chat generally. Just say hi, guys. But before we delve into the world of Volkswagen, we're going to look at what other news happened this week. And everything did kind of get overshadowed, so it hasn't been a crazy week in terms of news. But a few little things have popped up, guys. There's reports that finally, after 10 years, Rolls-Royce is going to launch a new Phantom.
Well,
finally.
Yeah, I mean, the Phantom was the first car Rolls-Royce made under BMW's stewardship, and it was an amazing car then. It kind of remains an amazing car now. It doesn't really have any rivals. I mean, the Mercedes brought back Maybach, but that's half the price. The Phantom really stands alone, and yet, even when your car stands alone, you can't, you know, freeze time.
No.
And that car is getting on. It's been around a long time. As good as it is, something new needs to happen. There's emissions regulations to meet. Yeah. There's all kinds of safety things you've got to meet. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. Rolls-Royce, of course, has a new SUV coming out soon as well. So we're really seeing that company ramp up.
I think it's actually called a go-anywhere vehicle, Mike, in their marketing. They are not referring to it as an SUV because that's probably too common and crass.
It is. And the interesting thing about that, to go on a slight tangent, is that the first Rolls-Royces were kind of built to go off-road. Because they were among the first cars, and there really weren't many roads, and they used to be built to go, that was their sort of thing, the car you could take further than any other, so it kind of makes sense.
They were just soccer mum cars from the beginning, let's be honest.
But it is interesting to see that company, you know, finally coming out with some new stuff.
After so long. It's interesting, though, because I wonder whether their buyers actually care that much. Like, as you say, emissions regulations, all of these things will force their hand, and they will have to, obviously, make changes to that car. But do Rolls-Royce buyers care that their car has like been on the market for 8 years, do you think?
I think you'd have a big problem convincing someone to spend $1 million on a car that they already have.
Yeah, right.
Particularly when, yeah, let's face it, something like that is all about appearance, as well as, you know, the cost-sitting luxury and all the things that go along with it. But if your neighbours don't realise that you have just dropped $1 million on a brand new car, what is the point in spending $1 million?
I have a pretty cool Rolls-Royce story. I went to Goodwood, where their factory is. And so, interestingly, their factory, they can't expand it or make it any higher because the Earl of March, whose property it is, has one condition of the factory being on his property, is that he can't see it from his bedroom window in his chateau.
Are you serious?
That's true. But the biggest part of Rolls-Royce is their customization arm. So, you know, the person who buys a $1 million Phantom doesn't just buy a $1 million Phantom. Yeah. They option it up. They have all sorts of things. And Rolls-Royce will do anything. They'll make the Spirit of Ecstasy badge out of solid gold if you want. They'll have any kind of cowhide or wood or whatever the hell you want. The best one, we asked the person who runs this whole thing, the best one he ever got was this buyer, I think he was from Hong Kong, wanted them to look up the exact star formation on the night of his birth in 1957 and then put that on the roof of the car, backlight it, and then with little pins put holes in the roof to correspond with the star formation.
That is.
So this is the kind of buyer we're talking about. So that's why, as Kez says, they need a new car.
It's quite interesting, actually, because sticking with Rolls, they their marketing head of marketing person was speaking to a colleague at Frankfurt, and they were saying with their non-SUV slash go-anywhere vehicle, let's call it a high-riding wagon, they want to attract female buyers and younger buyers. I mean, can that even happen?
Do women buy, and this isn't to make a gross generalisation, but I will anyway, do women buy Rolls-Royces? I think of Rolls-Royce as a very male-dominated kind of brand. Yeah. Just like, you know, I guess Ferrari and Bentley. I mean, there are undoubtedly women that buy these cars, but surely the ratio is predominantly blokes. Mm.
I think the big thing is maybe to try, and again, this is not trying to sound terrifyingly sexist, but if you can get wives or partners to say to their male partner, how about a Rolls-Royce, honey, that's probably the biggest decision maker. Or, you know, the biggest deal breaker that you'll find is, you know, if women aren't interested, then it's very easy for them to say, no, we're not having that. Mm. If you can attract them, they may not be the name on the contract, but they may be the one making the purchasing decision.
They're the decision makers. But I wonder if, like, you know, very wealthy women, very successful women, whether they would consider... I feel like it is a very male brand, and it is a very old... I can't imagine...
It's a musty brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like old Cuban cigars and mahogany furniture and books and fireplaces. And it's not a youthful, sexy brand.
Right?
It's not a cutting-edge, interesting, high-tech brand. And no doubt, BMW, who owns Rolls-Royce, wants to change that.
Yeah.
But there's 100 years of history there for them to reverse.
Yeah.
And very interestingly, amongst, I guess, big-dollar cars, I learnt the other day that Aston Martin has one of the highest percentages of female ownership amongst that kind of exclusive high-end group.
Really?
So in terms of Rolls-Royce versus Aston Martin from purely a styling point of view,
absolutely,
the two have absolutely nothing in common except that they have four wheels on the ground.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a big market to go after, and I think it's probably very wise of Rolls to consider that.
Yeah. Ladies, text in. Would you buy a Rolls-Royce if you had the money? 0427JOY949. We would love to hear your opinions. Now, boys, we're very excited about... Well, I'm very excited. I don't know about you guys, but about the Focus RS, Ford Focus
RS.
You
mean the Focus RS?
RS, the RS, that has some kind of ridiculous 0 to 100 time that I cannot remember right now.
The mid-fours, and that makes it faster than... Well, the fastest. It makes it faster than the V8 Mustang, I believe.
Yeah.
It's insane. Bonkers.
Well, they've gone and made a documentary about the darn thing.
Have they? Well, I'm guessing if Ford made a documentary about its own car, it's a glowing one. It's not going to be very hyper self-analytical, is it?
Well, it's funny you say that, because I watched the short to it this morning, and it says, it takes you through the highs, blah, blah, blah,
and the lows. The lows?
They actually say the lows, and there's two engineers driving.
You know, the low is, this car is just too good, damn it. It's too good.
No, unfortunately, I don't want to get out of it. I'm so in love with it. That is such a problem.
But the Focus ST is an amazing car, and the Focus RS, the previous gen one, was insane.
Bonkers.
There's no reason why this one can't be. I mean, Ford, when it puts its mind to doing a hot hatch, does it better than just about anybody.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting. I can't wait. And I've gotten used to the looks. I wasn't sure at first, and now I think it's
I love how it looks.
Yeah, okay. I didn't think it went far enough, but now I had
angry, big, ready-to-eat pavement kind of front intake that works.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Now, more closer to home, boys, very briefly, earlier this week, HSV revealed their Gen F2 range, which is probably their final you know.
Was there certainly
go
the final
the Commodore? Yeah.
Rear drive Commodore sort of thing.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they didn't make too many changes. They probably didn't have to. They've added that big 400 kilowatt LSA engine to some models, and they've upped the prices pretty much everywhere. These things still have appeal, and they're going to have appeal for a long time. So it's a bit of sadness as well.
Well, these cars, I think the most interesting thing is they will become massive collector's items in time. Mm. You know, in 20, 30 years, these things will be worth an absolute mint.
Yeah.
I mean, the real question with HSV is where does HSV go from here? I'm sure the company is working on some plans and ideas. Its bread and butter has always been V8 muscle cars.
Yeah.
Those are starting to die, and the ones that are around, you know, whether there's scope for HSV to get its hands on them to work on, who knows? It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah.
They have definitely been very coy about what they're going to do after the end of Commodore, and I sort of thought by now we'd see some lead-in of what kind of product they're going to get. It looks like Holden's are going to get the best of the performance product out of the Opel range.
Mm.
With things like the OPC and the Opel range, the VXR and the Vauxhall range, and they'll come here with the VXR badge. So what's left for HSV could be very interesting. And I know early on in the piece there was discussion that that may not be a Holden or GM product that HSV brings here. I think that's entirely unlikely.
Yeah.
Well, it's the H in HSV doesn't stand for Ford, does it? So, I mean, there's not a whole lot else they can do, surely.
That's a really odd thing. I think as well HSV will be very wise with this last range in terms of limited editions.
Yeah.
I reckon towards the end there'll be a lot, and those will be the ones that potentially could have their value flow through the roof. The other great thing about putting the LSA in lesser models that aren't the GTS is you'll be able to tune the crap out of it. So potentially you could have a GTS beta for less money than a GTS.
Yeah.
You know, with some fairly minimal modifications. Yeah. And the inner bogan in me absolutely loves
What do you mean inner bogan? You're wearing a flannel right now.
The outer bogan in me loves it as well.
Is there a Southern Cross tattoo on you somewhere?
Could be a couple, actually.
Oh, God. Oh, dear. But it's interesting, though, because that, you know, they will do some kind of limited edition thing, but is that going to hold people off from buying what's out there now?
Not
people
a chance.
Go, oh, you reckon?
No, no way. So, I know a very good friend of my brother's works as a performance tune shop. He specialises in American V8s.
Mm-hmm.
He owned a completely and utterly bonkers Maloo that he had built from the ground up to be super high power. When the Maloo GTS edition came out last year, he was pretty much one of those people that camped outside a HSV dealership to put a deposit down.
Yep.
Didn't faze him in the least. He will have already put down a deposit on a Gen F2.
Right.
And if there's a higher performance version of that Gen F2, he will camp outside a dealership and he'll do it again. Hardcore fans, really, I don't think bothers them too much. There'll be people that would struggle to make ends meet for one car, let alone two.
Yep.
Unfortunately, you know, if they rush in, they'll miss out. If there is no limited edition, they may go without. But for the hardcore fans, the real ardent HSV fans, I think no matter what, they'll find a way to get what they want.
They certainly will. They certainly will. We've got lots more coming up. Very shortly, we're going to be discussing the Volkswagen thing. A little bit later, we're going to talk about all the cars that have been launched in Australia this week. It's been a bonkers one, guys. So stick around. This is Fenderbender. This is Joy's very own motoring program, and it would be absolutely ludicrous of us if we did not discuss the big, fat German elephant in the room. And that is... Sorry, that sounded really rude, didn't it?
I'm right here. Oh, my God.
God, you're so mean.
Sorry. I'm trying to think of a German version of your surname, but I can't.
I'm about as non-German as you can possibly find.
Pretty non-German. It has been a big week for Volkswagen Group. We touched on it last week. It actually was unfolding last week, and we touched on it on the show, but we didn't have a lot of details. But now we kind of know a bit more what's happening. They have basically cheated on their emissions tests in the United States and potentially in other regions as well?
Yeah, well, the company came out on the front foot and pretty much said as much. Yeah. I guess that's damage control 101. The SH asterisk T has definitely hit the fan. But the key to damage control on a corporate level is to own up when you know you're caught and kind of take full responsibility. And the real big developments we've seen this week, and like I said, I've been trying to keep away from the industry and couldn't not, is that heads are starting to roll.
Yeah.
The biggest head of all, of course, being the biggest head in the Volkswagen Group, Martin Winterkorn, Professor Dr. Martin Winterkorn, who ran the company. And of course, Volkswagen is one of the 10 biggest companies in the world of any sort. We're not talking about just car companies here. The Volkswagen Group is a colossus.
Yeah.
It might be Germany's biggest brand. It's certainly one of Germany's biggest brands. Yep. It's got one of the vastest empires of any corporation in the world. Yeah. And it's starting to get rid of key executives. Wintercon's gone. There's rumours a whole bunch of other people high up in the company will go. And frankly, they have to. How can they not?
This is the thing. What's interesting about this, though, and I think you've touched on this before, Mike, is that Wintercon has only recently won a bit of a power struggle.
Well, this is kind of an extension of a saga that we saw a few months ago where the kind of patriarch of the Volkswagen family that ran the company was ousted in an internal battle, and then there was all controversy over that and big infighting, and now the guy who took over has been forced to resign or was dismissed almost straight away. So it's been a very dramatic period of time for Volkswagen.
Yep.
But there are so many questions coming from this. I mean, obviously the issue at hand is that the diesel cars were emitting more than they were allowed to because there was a way that Volkswagen could make them perform better in tests than in the real world. But the real questions are coming to light, basically. Why did Volkswagen think it could get away with this?
Yeah.
Who knew about this? And clearly the high-ups within the company either knew about it, or if they didn't know about it, why didn't they know about it? And then the other question is, well, how far does this thing stretch? I mean, Volkswagen has more R&D money than any other company in the business. You know, billions and billions and billions of euros they spend on developing cars. And if they can't develop a car that fits these emissions regs, is anyone else guilty? Is anyone else doing this? So there are a whole bunch of questions coming out. It's, you know, 80 billion euros in fines and charges and other things, and it's going to keep going. There's going to be class action lawsuits. There's going to be all sorts of fallout from this. You can see this becoming simply the biggest motoring story almost ever.
Yeah.
Really. It's that major.
It's pretty bonkers. It is pretty outrageous, though, that they've somebody or people or group or whatever, however it's happened, that they've made the conscious decision to deceive people. And I think that's what's so galling and why the public are so up in arms about it. A lot of people who don't really have any knowledge of or interest in the automotive industry are quite shocked, and people are saying they'll never buy a Volkswagen again. But to get down to that level of who makes that decision, I mean, as you say, they've got so much R&D spend that they could, you know, use for this kind of technology. Wouldn't you go, okay, we can't actually make this happen, so let's push back against the Euro government, the European Union, who are enforcing all of these really strict emissions laws, and go, we just can't do this. If we're one of the biggest companies on the planet, rather than lie and cheat, just go back, we couldn't do it, guys, sorry.
You would think that they hold enough sway to be able to do that. The other problem is, of course, being a major company with a huge R&D spend, someone somewhere along the development chain turns around and says, you need to be able to do this to this product at this price. If the development team comes back and says, look, we've got a solution to the emissions requirement, it's going to cost us this much, and then your head bloke turns around and says, look, that is far too expensive, do something better. Ultimately, at the end of the day, if you've your team has worked to the end of that solution and cannot find a way to do it better, then, you know, the temptation is there to do what they've done and to create a subterfuge to kind of get around the testing requirement rather than getting around that requirement across the board.
But it's not just you know, the fact that Volkswagen's hidden things. It's the sheer discrepancy between what the cars were claimed to emit and what they were emitting. So if we go take a bit of a back step here, just for those who aren't aware, this all stems from some private investigations from a couple of guys in the US. Cars are tested rigorously for the amount of emissions they put into the atmosphere, and they're required to, you know, only have a certain amount of emissions. It turns out that in testing, Volkswagen was able to get these cars to the right level, but there was a system that allowed the cars to emit that much in testing because it knew when it was being tested, but at the rest of the time, it was emitting, what was the number, 30 or 40 times
30
higher?
30 to 40 times higher, which is not not a 5 to 10%
discrepancy. Yeah, we're not talking a little bit higher. We're talking about cars emitting a staggering amount, really, in that scheme.
And we're also talking about diesel emissions, which are now recognised by the World Health Organization as particularly harmful. Yeah. So 40 times as much.
They're carcinogenic now. They've officially said that causes cancer.
The French government, for one, which really was a big reason that European diesels were as popular as they were, is because of rulings by the French government that diesels should be the way forward.
Right.
And there was, you know, things like tax and registration exemptions for them. Even the French government has turned around in the last 12 months and said, we realise that this is not the way forward because it's potentially harmful.
Sugar.
So that's under review as well. So ultimately what you're looking at is a case where this just gets bigger and bigger and bigger because of the health implications, because of the volume of emissions that these vehicles are producing. Like it's an enormous, it's an enormous abuse of trust and potentially it has ongoing health benefits, not just for the owners of those cars, but for everyone who is, you know, particularly in urban environments where there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of cars on the road. Everyone is breathing that in. So, you know, Volkswagen will be hugely, hugely accountable in years to come for this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, diesel cars emit less CO2, and for a long time that was the thing. People said, we've got to emit less CO2. But, of course, there's all sorts of other particulates that diesel cars put out, and there are filters and things that have been developed to stop this, but nevertheless, the levels are a lot higher. And as Kez sort of alluded to there, the real question for me that goes beyond that in terms of a tech perspective is, is this the death of diesel in passenger cars? Diesel has applications for commercial vehicles. It's the only fuel you can use for big trucks, for things that tow, you know, because diesel engines have certain characteristics because of the way they burn. But for passenger cars, this has to be the end.
It has to be the
beginning of the end, the slow death of diesel, because the upside to petrol is much higher.
Yeah.
More electrification is creeping into cars to offset any, you know, issues that they have. And if the world's biggest car company can't get it right, then very few surely can.
It's interesting because I don't want to say that I told you so, world, but I've always been skeptical of diesels since day one when I started this job. Like, I never understood, like, small little diesel hatchbacks. I'm like, why would you bother? It just never kind of...
Diesel has some redeeming characteristics if you drive long distances. If you drive a long distance. But if you're just pottering around a city... I used to sell cars, and I always used to say... I used to sell Volkswagens, as a matter of fact. And I used to say, you buy petrol for the city, because diesels in the city, to me, don't make sense. They're designed for long distances. Yeah. In Europe, it makes a kind of sense because they've got a big highway culture. You drive, you know, from town to town at high speeds, fuel's really expensive. It makes a little more sense there.
I'll tell you who's wringing their hands with glee right now. Elon Musk from Tesla.
From Tesla.
And who else is Toyota? Because Toyota's basically given up on diesel with Lexus and a lot of its cars, the Prius as well. They've been saying petrol electric hybrid is the future for a long time now.
Yeah.
So there are companies that kind of perhaps all this coming, who knows?
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as this Volkswagen thing is concerned, it's going to keep growing, it's going to keep building. There's going to be more people that will go, no doubt. I believe it's been confirmed now that Matthias Müller, the head of Porsche, has taken over as
the head cheese at Volkswagen.
Now, he's been around in that group for a long time. Before he was head of Porsche, he was very high up in Volkswagen and Audi in different departments of the corporation. So, you know, surely, who knows? Yeah. Clearly, his hands are relatively clean, you would think. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bumped him into the top role.
And you would think that they would have enough resources to do their background checks on people to triple check that his hands are clean.
But this is going to cost them, you know, probably more than 100 billion euros to clean up. So where does Volkswagen go from here?
And that's the question. Like, what happens to the brand? I mean, just in the last week, speaking to different people who are involved with the industry and not involved with the industry, everyone has a different opinion on what's going to happen. I personally think it will have an impact for the short to medium term. And I think there'll be people who will remember and not trust the brand ever again. I think potentially they might lose enough sales to maybe slip to number two this year. I don't know. But long term, I think people are still going to buy Volkswagens.
Well, you have a look at recent times with General Motors. You know, they were caught deliberately hiding the fact that their cars were killing people.
Yeah.
It's a lot more serious, really.
And they're not the first.
The biggest recall just about ever. Yeah. And then just after that, the biggest recall ever was called it with the Takata airbag saga, also killed many people. These issues, you could argue, I mean, until the issues with a car putting a lot of stuff in the atmosphere has health consequences for people, but it's very hard to draw a direct correlation between that and death, whereas these other situations you could. We have seen enormous corporate incompetence on huge levels from a lot of car makers recently, and people forget pretty fast. They really do.
They really do.
And
the difference is, though, I guess, that this is, as you said before, I think, Mike, this is not incompetence. This is just sheer deception.
Oh, yeah. They knew all along.
I think people don't like being deceived, but I agree. Look, it will have an impact. I think people will move on.
The fact that other car makers aren't jumping on this and saying, hey, don't go to Volkswagen, buy us, tells me there's more to come.
Yeah.
I think every car maker in the world is quietly terrified right now.
And I think they're all turning very quickly to their documentation, reviewing their procedures to make sure that they're not in the same boat before they boldly say anything that could see them in just as much trouble.
Well, the independent mob that tested these Volkswagens tested a BMW, I think it was an X5, and it passed with flying colours. So that is one indication that maybe it's not happening widespread. Who knows? But
It's well, and Daimler's just come out today as well and kind of denied. They've said that they have never done anything like that as well. So I think there's going to be a lot of other car makers. PSA, Peugeot, Citroen have said there needs to be stricter regulations and controls on this, and they're denying anything as well. So you're seeing a lot of this.
One of the companies within the Volkswagen Group announced that they are completely free of any sort of issue.
Who is that?
Lamborghini. Honestly, that is without a word of a lie. So they do not have a diesel in the range, and they produce some fairly emissions unfriendly V10 and V12 engines.
But at least they're honest about it.
They thought they'd weigh in. Honestly, was there any point?
That's hilarious.
It's bizarre.
But I think as well, if you're listening and you're a Volkswagen owner as well in Australia, unfortunately, we don't know whether the vehicles in this market have been affected or and the local Volkswagen Group people apparently are waiting word from their head office about what to do in Australia.
Well, the reality of it is every single Volkswagen region in the world is right now screaming at head office in Wolfsburg, Germany, saying, what the hell? What do we tell our buyers? What do we tell our customers? And it's such a scrabble fest at the moment that I'm sure when Volkswagen Australia says, listen, we're trying to get to the bottom of this, we're trying to work out what cars, if any, we have been affected, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. I think they're trying. Yeah. I think it's pretty hard to get anything out of Volkswagen globally at the moment. But look, Volkswagen makes cars for the world. Yeah. Australia doesn't have different cars to Europe necessarily. Obviously, there are different variants within. But the diesel engines that are sold in Europe are sold in Australia. Mm. So you can probably put two and two together to work out if there's going to be a problem or not. Yeah. But then the issue is, you know, these cars are not safety risks. These cars aren't crashing. They're not having issues. They're not breaking down. It's an emissions thing. Yeah. So it's very different to some of the recalls we've perhaps heard in the past.
I think just very briefly getting back to the whole trust in the brand thing, this is, as you said, one of the biggest companies in the world. Now, there are a bunch of other companies, and we're not going to name them here because I can't afford a lawyer, but a lot of other companies, non-automotive companies, that have been accused of consistently deceiving their own consumers as well, whether it's a food company making claims about the healthiness or whatever whether it's fast food or packaged foods. There's deception everywhere in the consumer world. Is this a big surprise? Like, should we be this shocked by it?
Well, I mean, companies aren't separate entities. They're just, collections of humans. Mm. We think of companies as being these others, this other, but they're not. It's just a bunch of people who are in a position of power who make a thing and have to meet a thing, have to meet requirements and have to cut costs. And, all these things build up. And human beings deceive. Human beings are dishonest. Human beings make mistakes. That's what all corporations consist of. So no, not really.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's just
and I guess the other big question is, well, does this mean that the regulations put on car makers are unreasonable?
Well, good
point. If car companies are resorting to things like this to get around them, I mean, to the degree 30 or 40 times higher emissions, probably not. But if other companies are caught with slightly higher emissions, maybe, then these are the other questions you have to ask.
Well, hopefully it will also mean more transparency within car makers, development processes and stuff like that. That would be a positive outcome here. And look, if you are concerned, I would go and contact your Volkswagen dealer. They probably won't be able to tell you a lot right now.
But just be aware that this doesn't mean your cars are going to break down. It doesn't mean your cars are death traps or dangerous or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's the amount of stuff they're putting in the air, which is a problem, but it's not about your car not working anymore.
And so you're not immediately at risk.
No, not even slightly.
Unless you're putting your mouth around the exhaust pipe.
There's the third euphemism that we
Thank
were speaking
you.
Of.
Woo-hoo! Right, I knew it was going to happen. The lovely gang from Technogaze will also be talking about this from a more technical perspective in about half an hour's time, so stick around for them as well. This is Fender Bender on Joy 94.9. We're going to move right away from Volkswagen and move right along. It is Joy 949. You are with Tim, Mike and Kez, and we have just purged on Volkswagen news. I mean, I feel a little German. I feel like I could eat a big sausage right now. A Kransky, something like that. Or I'm going to stop talking about that kind of thing right now.
That'd be number four.
Four, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dirty, dirty birds.
On the euphemism tally for Tim.
That's it. But we are going to stick in Europe. We are going to stay in Europe. Mike, you were away for a little while. You had a bit of fun times in Frankfurt. Now, I've got to ask you, we talked about Frankfurt last week on the show, but you weren't here. Tell me, please, what was your pick of the show?
There were two. First was Renault Megane, the new gen Renault Megane. My argument,
really?
My argument being, it's very easy to make a concept or a supercar look amazing, but to make a humble golf rivaling C-segment hatchback like that look so sharp and have such a good interior is very, very difficult to do. So I thought it was really impressive on that level. Haven't driven it, but poked around. It's pretty impressive.
What's it look like at the back? Is the tail lights at all?
Love it.
Really?
And the interiors basically trickle down from the higher end cars like the Talisman and the Espace. So it's a very premium cabin. It's got that très chic French design that we know and love. And yeah, the engine's a carryover, so who knows how it will drive. We're going to find out. And the other one was the Porsche Mission E, which is Porsche's Tesla Model S rival. It is validation of Tesla, if ever there was one, despite what Porsche may say. It's merely an indication Volkswagen is terrified of Tesla and is making a 500-kilometre range electric luxury sedan. But the good news is it looks phenomenal. It's a sure sign of what the next Panamera will look like. And since the current Panamera is so hideously ugly, to see one that looks like that will be excellent.
That was, I've got to say, that was, because I wasn't blown away at all by this, the show cars this year, but that was the one that made my pants
stunning.
Stand up.
Stunning. Stunning, stunning, stunning. Yeah. And also the car.
Yeah.
Oh,
listen to it.
But yes, obviously the Frankfurt show, world's biggest motor show. This was the biggest version of the world's biggest show in history. Yeah. So, and the fact that we only had a couple of highlights may say something about the state of things at the moment.
That's true. But you were not just German. You had a bit of taste of the French as well.
I did. Spent some time in France, partially to go and have a look at Renault's very exciting decision to bring back the Alpine badge. Mm. Alpine was it's a 50-year old French sports car company. It, you know, specializes in ultra lightweight, rally focused road sports cars. They never made many cars. They only had three main road going models, the most famous being the A110 Berlinette. And these cars in France are quite iconic. I went to a festival in the town of Dieppe where they're from, and you know, hundreds of people turned up with their cars. They're really well known. Not really that well known anywhere else though, and yet Renault has decided to bring it back because it wants to come up with a sub brand, a sporty brand. Renault Sport does derivations of current Renault cars, but Alpine will make its own whole cars. Okay. We don't know exactly what the car's going to be. We do know it's going to be built in the same plant as the RS Clio. My understanding, having spoken to a number of people involved in the project, is it's likely to use the engine, the 1.6 turbo engine and paddle shifter gearbox from the Clio as well. It'll weigh about a ton. It'll be an ultra lightweight two-seat coupe.
Wow.
It'll be built mostly by hand. It'll probably cost about $70,000-$80,000.
Now, because this was maybe going back a couple of years, they were hooked up with Caterham, is that right?
Yes, and that whole thing fell over, and that's why the delay has happened, and it's why we won't see the car until the Paris Motor Show next year in October, and it will come to Australia early in 2017. Right-hand drive is confirmed. Australia is all but confirmed. It'll come here, let's be honest. We're one of the world's biggest Renault Sport markets anywhere, so it'll definitely come here. It's really exciting to see and to get an idea of, because, you know, I knew nothing about Alpine, so I had to kind of experience it. And I was lucky enough to go for a drive in a 1973 A110, which is what the new car will look like. It's their iconic car, and the new one's going to look just like it. A bit bigger, a bit more modernized, but essentially the same thing. And these cars, you know, dominated rally in Europe for a long time there, and to drive this car was quite amazing. You drive a car of that vintage, of that era, of that performance. Fiberglass car, weighs 700 kilos, only a 1600cc engine, but you don't need a lot of power for a car that light. You know, four-speed gearbox, drives a bit like a truck. I barely fit in the thing. But then I got to sit in the passenger seat while Jean Ragnotti, a World Rally Championship driver who drove an Alpine and won the Monte Carlo Rally in an Alpine, took me for a proper drive. This guy just turned 70. And yet, in typical French relaxed fashion, just took me for a fang on a wet country road in France, exactly as this car was intended to be driven.
Awesome.
Not a whole lot of safety, just go for it and hope for the best. Luckily, the best is what I got. Who knows? But the guy's a maniac. Told me he didn't speak much English, then proceeded to speak lots of English the entire time, so I think he's a bit modest. But it was an unbelievable experience, and I really got a feel for what Alpine is, to see the passion of, you know, the French motoring scene for this brand, to see what the brand was once capable of, to see the fact that Renault is very much leaving it alone. Renault's strategy seems to be, here's some money, go and do your thing. Oh. Use some of our parts, but you've got enough to make your own platform, your own body, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
It should be kind of exciting.
So it will be its own platform. It's not going to be...
It'll be a version.
Right.
So it'll use Renault bits.
Yeah.
But it's going to definitely be a sub-brand. Just like Porsche is a sub-brand of Volkswagen, this is what Alpine will be. It won't be Renault Alpine. It won't be Alpine Renault. It'll be its own thing.
Does it have a badge yet? Have they got like a logo?
Alpine's got its own badge. Yeah. So it goes back a while. So it's
like
spelt
a stylized A.
It's spelt like Alpine. So snow. Yeah. If you're interested.
Lights.
If you're interested in... exactly. If you're interested in what what the A110 looked like. Yeah. Google the Alpine A110. Beautiful car.
The problem, well, not the problem, well, it could be a problem, is how, as you say, that this brand doesn't really have any kind, unless you're a real enthusiast, like I wouldn't have heard about it until a couple of years ago, how is that going to break through in Australia when it's not known?
Well, that's a big question, and that's why they have to, A, make it look right, and B, have to price it right. But if they can come out with a French, lightweight, rear-wheel drive, high-performance, possibly mid-engine sports car, 60, 70 grand, it'll sell itself.
Yeah.
You know, and the badge equity is something people can learn. People can say, hey, my car has some history. Great. But it's not a car that can be sold purely on its history. It has to be good enough on its own. And the badge is just kind of a bit of topping.
That's also going to be like the ultimate hipster car then, if it's not known in Australia.
Yeah, people are going to be into it before it becomes cool.
Yeah.
Well, an interesting thing about badge history, I don't think it matters anymore whether that history is known or not, as long as there's history.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, and purely I say this because there is like a lot of Chinese manufacturers that are trying to buy stagnant brands to attach to their own cars. One of those that we saw at Frankfurt was Borgward.
Oh, yes.
Which is building an SUV that is based off, is it parent company, Geely?
I thought it was Foton.
There you
but
go.
I could be wrong.
No. But ultimately, you're looking at fairly mundane underpinnings, but they've slapped on a badge that hasn't been seen in Europe since the 1960s in the hope that that will convince Chinese buyers predominantly that it's a luxurious and known brand.
Yeah.
Now, in the last 50 years, if nobody's seen that badge, that's what they're pinning their hopes to. Ultimately, Renault is going to do the same thing with Alpine. I don't think it matters that people are familiar with the history, but as long as you can put posters on the wall that say, this is our history, this is what it looks like, this is what we've done in the past, you'll get heads nodding in agreement and ultimately translate that to sales.
And it's French.
Well,
No, this is the good thing about it. It's a very famous, très chic, cool French brand, and that's people love that sort of stuff. They can't get enough of it. So I think it'll go well. And Renault makes an amazing sports car. The Mégane RS, the Clio RS, and the RS division is helping tune this car.
Yeah.
There's no reason why it won't be amazing.
That's true. I am in a Clio RS this week, and I'm already having a lot of fun. So,
interestingly, Australia makes up 10% of the world's Clio RS sales.
Really?
And yet we make up less than 0.5% of Renault's total sales.
We are a pack.
Hence why Renault loves Australia, because they sell all their luxury in sports cars here.
So they should.
Yeah.
You are listening to Fender Bender. We have got a little bit more coming up before the gang from Technogaze takes over, so make sure you stick around.
Hi, this is Kylie Minogue, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
I just can't ever get sick of that promo.
You just can't get out of your head? Is that what you're saying?
I've got to be certain.
This writes itself.
Right. It does, doesn't it? We could be here for days doing this kind of crap. Now, Kez Casey.
Yes, Tim Nicholson.
I heard a rumour.
Are we going to talk about that on air? I thought that was...
None of it's true. None of it's true. At all?
No, no.
I don't care what you read in the toilet stall. It is not even remotely true.
I think he denies that a bit too vociferously. There might be something to that.
You don't even know what the rumour is. Now, look, it's been a huge week, boys. This week, Mike, you've missed a whole week of crazy launch activity in Australia.
I've had a better time, but anyway.
Yeah, you absolutely would have, I can assure you. But wait, you've missed out on the new Mazda BT50.
Wow!
Woo!
Slightly less ugly.
It's got a slightly new face.
It is a good car, the BT50.
It's great.
And the really fun thing about that new face is that if you visit your Mazda parts department, you can order headlights, grille and taillights that will slot into your existing BT50 and make it look a whole lot better.
Really?
Shh.
Oh.
Shush. No,
no. No. There we go.
Nobody would do that.
Never.
Never.
But you can also put a big old bull bar on the front as well.
And hide most of the problem. You can, yourself from animal strike. Man. Absolutely.
It is. Look at, you know, but it is a great ute, and it's a bit of an underappreciated ute in Australia. It doesn't sell as well as some of the others, but that, so the new version of that, but it's also not as much of an upgrade as we've seen from the Ranger, which it's kind of related to. What else have we seen updated this year? I can't even remember. Well, Navara.
We've got a new Navara. We've got a new Hilux arriving, so there's a lot of fresh competition. And a very minor update to the BT50.
Just very quickly, I heard a really interesting rumour about the BT50 from a very high up person in Mazda. Mazda has just signed a co-op deal with Toyota. There is a potential opportunity there for the next BT50 to not be Ford Ranger based like the current one, but to potentially be a Hilux based vehicle. It's being potentially investigated.
Which
Mazda isn't saying a whole lot, but you know, you can kind of guests and take some understandings out of conversations that you have, which would be extremely interesting.
Absolutely. But it also makes sense for them, like Mazda is a small car company by global standards, and for them to pour their own R&D money into a ute that doesn't sell in every market.
It can't do it alone. No, it simply can't. It can either stick with Ford. It's got a joint factory in Thailand where it builds Rangers and BT50s. Or it could, you know, explore its new developing relationship with Toyota. Ooh. More will be discovered in time, but it's an interesting thing to keep in the back of your mind.
That's true. Now, the other things that got launched this week, guys, with the Volkswagen Golf R Wolfsburg Edition and the All-Track Wagon. So, a couple of
Volkswagen love that Volkswagen did a launch this week. Oh God, you got to feel sorry for them a bit, don't you?
The poor guys, they couldn't say a lot, apparently, but those cars are very fun. Some other Germans that got launched this week, of course, were, well, I guess it's kind of one car, but it's two cars. The Mercedes-Benz GLE Kes. It's two cars, it is.
So it is two cars. You've got Mercedes-Benz GLE SUV and the Mercedes-Benz GLE Coupe. The Coupe is a new
edition.
It's
not a Coupe.
It's not a Coupe at all. However, that's the badge that... Well, it's not actually the badge that's attached to it. That's the official name that's attached to it. The GLE hatchback, would that be better?
Potentially.
Is essentially a competitor to the BMW X6. Mm-hmm. The BMW X6 is what started the SUV coupe movement. So instead of being a wagon back, it's a kind of sloped off fastback liftgate style thing. So the GLE itself replaces the ML. Mm-hmm. In the Mercedes-Benz lineup.
Family-sized SUV,
It's a large SUV, but it is only a five-seater. There's no seven-seat option in the GLE.
Right.
For that, you need to look to the GL.
Which will soon become GLS.
The GLS.
Yeah. That is a gigantic whale.
And for the time being, it is an enormous whale, but it's not a bad thing at all.
No.
And for the time being, the GLE is the entry into Mercedes-Benz SUV range until the GLC, which is slightly smaller, arrives next year.
Yep. Which I drove in Europe not long ago and can't get enough of. It's a brilliant thing.
Oh, yeah.
Brilliant car.
Sell its socks off.
Yes. And the reason that Benz has changed all these names is because the GLC lines up with a C-Class, the GLE lines up with an E-Class.
Yeah.
In theory. So, the GLE... SUV has a range of engines. You've got a four-cylinder diesel, a six-cylinder diesel, a six-cylinder turbo petrol, a turbocharged V8, and the top range topping GLE 63S.
Ooh, yeah.
Which is the AMG variant, which is completely and utterly bonkers.
Is it?
Like, you're looking at 430 kilowatts in something that hauls the kids to school in record time.
Look, you need that, though, getting around the streets of Brighton, I do.
But, of course, with this car, the BMW X5, so Mercedes in Australia murders BMW in sales, but in this segment, the X5 from BMW is clearly the leader.
Yeah.
It's not just the best car, it's the best-selling car out there. The GLE appears to be not a wholesale change over the ML. It appears to be more of a sort of update. Has Mercedes done enough? Is this car as good as an X5? That's the question.
I think, look, we've seen examples before where a small change makes a big difference to sales, and I think that this is probably going to be one of those ones where it does. Particularly on the inside, once you get in it, you sit down, you look at the dash, which has copped a fairly major revision. I think that'll sway a lot of people. It's now nicer to look at, easy to use. Most, but not all models in the range get things like a stitched dash and stitched door cards and things like that. So it looks properly premium now. It feels really nice to use. That will make a big difference to buyers. The price is a little bit more expensive than an X5 to start with, but they've added a lot of kit as well. So you get things like push-button start, powered tailgate, radar cruise control, collision detection. All of that comes as standard now across the range. So I know it seems odd to talk about value in a car that starts at $89,000, but they've improved the value equation on most of the variants in the range as well.
I mean, a Ford Everest starts at $80,000, well, so exactly. 89 for a Merc ain't
exactly
that bad, really, is it?
But the thing that's new and different is the GLE Coupe, and the GLE Coupe doesn't have everything that the GLE SUV has. One of the variants that it does have, which is new for Mercedes-Benz, is the Mercedes-Benz GLE 450 AMG.
Oh, yes.
So it's not a full AMG version, but it's an AMG enhanced version of the GLE 400.
It's the AMG you have when you can't afford an AMG.
So it's the Diet Coke of AMG.
Yes. So what you get is handling that's been tailored by AMG. You get the exhaust system off the 63.
Cool.
So a bimodal exhaust that makes all sorts of cool noises. And to me, it is the absolute pick of the range.
Is it?
Absolutely.
Yep.
It is great to drive. It uses like half the fuel of the 63.
Right.
It is quiet enough when you need it to be. Like, you cannot go anywhere in the 63 without turning heads because it has a loud exhaust that even in its quietest setting is just monstrous. But it is a lot of fun. The unfortunate thing is the 450 only comes in the coupe. You cannot get it in the SUV.
Okay. Is that going to change?
Or that's not likely to change. Oh. But what we'll also see is things like next year there'll be a C450 AMG, so that engine will go into a C-Class. And there is talk that the E-Class, the new E-Class, which arrives next year as well, will also get that version as well. So, because normally there's been a big gap between the non-AMG and the AMG versions. Yep. This fills that gap, and I think it does it in a way that, for most people, will outshine the AMG version, and in the process you save like $40,000.
Well, so not everyone needs that level of brutal performance.
But nobody needs that level of performance.
But there are a lot of people, though, that really, really like the AMG look. And, you know, dealers are getting requests, can I get this body kit on a lesser car? Ultimately, you can't. You can do it, you know, again, through parts departments, and it's going to cost you an absolute fortune because AMG bumpers and wheels and things aren't cheap. So this is, essentially, this is the way to buy the car that looks like an AMG, handles a lot like an AMG, goes a lot like an AMG, but still leaves enough in reserve for those top spec models, and works really well as a result.
Good-o. So you're on notice, BMW, with your swoopy X6. And everyone else can do that.
I would say the GLE Coupe looks better than the X6. Even though it's a total rip-off of the X6.
Yep.
And let's not lie, I mean, BMW's ripped off Mercedes in the past before, so they rip each other off. And they can't not have a car that the other one has. They have to always do the same thing. But in this instance, I think Benz has done a more resolved job of it.
Yeah.
I think so. And I think because the SUV wears the same front end as the coupe but hasn't had any changes to the rear, it looks a little dowdy, I guess, whereas the
SUV.
Yeah, whereas the coupe, it was styled in one hit, and it looks much nicer as a result.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of the CO. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. Sorry, I don't know why I'm getting dramatic. It's my dramatic background.
You are very dramatic.
I did study acting. But I was kicked out because I failed too many
subjects. I was going to say, were you very good at it?
I was okay. Let's not go into that.
It's kind of weird that you're behind a sort of transparent white screen and all I see is a shadow and you're moving against
exactly.
It. It's very conceptual. I quite like it.
Thank you, Marcel Massaro. Mike and Kez, thank you boys so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Enjoy yourself, Mike. I hope you get some sleep this weekend and then you can dive back into the motoring world next week.
No. I'm taking another week off.
Not allowed.
Motoring world just hold us horses for a while.
Exactly. Do stick around, though. The boys, the gang, rather, from Technogaze will be up very, very shortly, and they've got lots and lots to get through. My name is Tim Nicholson, signing off for another week of Fender Bender. Safe driving.
This has been a Fender Bender podcast for Joy 94.9, Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station. See joy.org.au for more details.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.